This is case number 58628, Truesdale versus State of Nevada. Please make sure that you identify yourself for purposes of the record. If you wish to reserve any time, please let us know how much. And if you've caught your breath, please proceed.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. My name is Sharon Dickinson, and I represent Joseph Truesdale. I also have a trial attorney here, Casey Landis. He's no longer in our office, but he did agree to come. So he will be helping me out at the table. With the court's permission, I'd like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal. Okay. Now, as in this case, we've raised 10 separate distinct issues, all of which we believe are meritorious. However, I'm going to focus on issue two, the issue that has to do with the ex parte TPO, the temporary restraining order.
And Mr. Is your argument that the statute requires a telephone conference between the judge and the applicant for the temporary protective order, and that the evidence did not indicate that occurred, or are there other issues there you'd like to focus on?
Yes, that's one of the issues. The other issue is whether or not a telephone communication is sufficient for due process. And the reason I bring that up is if the court looks at Exhibit 11, States Exhibit 11, which is the order that the family court judge signed, he claims that he reviewed an affidavit and had a verified petition. Now, the state and Joseph, we all agree, there was no affidavit, there was no verified petition. So it would seem to suggest to me that the family court judges believe that they are getting, perhaps, verified petitions, or at least in this case, whoever signed it did not review what paperwork he was
signing. As a preliminary matter, why should you be allowed to challenge the TPO in this proceeding when it is, in fact, was a separate and distinct proceeding which no appeal had been taken from, or a writ run?
Your Honor, we should be allowed to challenge it in this particular proceeding because it's used as an element of the offense, the TPO. It's a home invasion in violation of a temporary restraining order. If the temporary protective order, if the TPO is not valid, then the state should not be allowed to use it against Joseph to enhance his penalty or to show the element that he did not have consent.
But don't we start with a presumption of validity where there's been no appeal or no writ taken as to the validity of that underlying judgment?
Well, yes and no. I mean, no as far as search warrants. We always assume that search warrants are valid, but we're allowed to challenge those every day in criminal cases. Frequently, they're not valid on their face.
But they're not a separate proceeding. This TPO is filed under another criminal number and was another separate proceeding unto itself. And that TPO did expire, but having said that, still, there was no challenge, so it comes forward with a certain amount of validity.
Well, there was no challenge for two reasons. One is that with an ex parte TPO, there's a very limited amount of time where you could make a challenge. The order in itself says you have to give the court at least 2 judicial days. In this particular case, when Joseph was allegedly served, there was a 3-day weekend. There was absolutely no way he could have challenged it. It would have been moot by the time he went down to family court. The second reason it's not challenged is that defendants are not given all the paperwork that goes with the order. In this case, the attorneys weren't even given all the paperwork that went with the order. It wasn't until the day before the trial that the trial attorney received the paperwork of the petition. So there's no way Joseph would have known that it was not obtained correctly, and there's no way his attorney even knew until he finally was given it the day before trial. In fact, he asked for a continuance so he could research the validity of this ex parte TPO, and that was denied.
There was some discussion in the record about the delay in trial, that the trial had been continued, I guess, once or twice previously at the request of the defense, and now this request on the eve of trial. Why wasn't the court correct in denying any continuance at that time? that the defense should have discovered if it was in the purview of the defense to be able to assess those records if they thought they might be important?
Well, for two reasons. One is that the state has a duty to turn over evidence to the defense. In this case, they purposely withheld it until we asked for it. Had they given it to us, like they give us Brady material, we don't have to ask for it, we would have known immediately that there was a problem here. We would have been able to investigate SafeNest and the family court's procedures and the fact that all of this is on the Internet. But we didn't have that opportunity. So I would suggest that we didn't have a responsibility to get it. The state had a responsibility to give it to us because it certainly could be construed as Brady material. And they gave it to us, but they gave it to us the day before trial. If you look at the telephone numbers on the top of the order and the top of the application, you can see all of these were received or sent at the same time.
Now, Ms. Davidson, just in the 8th Judicial District Court and the TPOs and Family Court, can that material be viewed electronically? Can you go onto their case management system and under that case number that the TPO was entered and just print out the documents from it?
I don't know. I don't know if you can or not. I didn't try beforehand to see if that's possible. I know a lot of things down in the family court, such as in the juvenile area, are all protected. You can't obtain access to it.
I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. I was just curious. Maybe the state knows if a TPO, I don't know if it's sealed. I don't know if it's accessible as a public record just on the through the case management system.
On the order, they indicate that they sent a copy of it to the Nevada Registry, and they sent a copy to the family. There's a family department that handles these in the government down there, and they sent a copy to SafeNest. So I'm not sure if it's available to anybody else or not, but it is apparently put on the registry. I don't know how you gain access to it.
I assume your client was a party to it, so he could have obtained it at some point in time, but I didn't know if it's just a general public record that you can get any of this information.
I'm not sure.
Okay.
I'm not sure about that.
The motion to continue, I think, was an oral motion. It was filed the day before the trial, and the court denied that. You're saying it was an oral motion because your client just got this information the day before, so there wasn't time to do a formal written motion at all.
That's correct. The trial attorney started investigating it, realized for the first time that there was some paperwork. He told the court he thought there would be no paperwork available. And when he discovered it, he just asked for continuance to research it and file a motion. The court said you could file the motion later and wanted to go to trial accepting the TPO as valid. The motions were not filed later because our trial attorney ended up leaving our office. So you can see at the sentencing hearing, he's no longer in the public defender's office. But we suggest that that doesn't waive any objection. He made plenty of objections to this before the trial and during the trial, and he objected to the order being admitted when it was admitted through the corrections officer. So we would suggest it has not been waived just because it was not filed later.
Now, on the vagueness issue, though, I don't think that was challenged in district court. Didn't the court say it would defer ruling until after the trial, or maybe you can enlighten me on what exactly happened?
On the vagueness with
the constitutional issue you talked about.
No, the court didn't rule on that during the trial. That was not brought up. If we're talking about the same issue, about home invasion?
Right, there was an issue, and please correct me, the court said it was made prior to the trial. There was a challenge. The court said, look, I'm not going to consider it now, but I will consider it post-trial if it becomes an issue then like that.
Oh, that was the vagueness challenge,
right,
to the ex parte TPO application under NRS 33.020.
Right.
Right, that's what the court said it would
consider. Okay, the post-trial, there was no challenge made.
No, and I would suggest to the court that it did not need to be litigated post-trial because we already made an objection. It's sort of like the court saying, okay, file a motion for a new trial. you have 7 days, rather than taking the time to really decide the issue that was at hand. So the court just delayed it.
Can I ask you about one other issue? I know you've got a lot of them, but we look at all the various issues here. Yeah. You've alleged prosecutorial misconduct because there was a statement made by the prosecutor that the defense was attempting to mislead the jury, and what were your thoughts on that?
Well, there are three different statements that the prosecutor made. One had to do with him telling the jury that the defense attorney was just trying to invoke sympathy and was trying to confuse them. The defense attorney objected, and the court sustained the objection. Mm-hmm. However, that was already before the jury at that point.
Judge tell the jury to disregard that statement made by...
I don't recall that the judge did that.
But there was a jury instruction given at the end that any argument of counsel is not evidence.
I believe there was. But there were two other objections, too. It was one misstating the law and the other misstating the facts. And those are very serious. The prosecutor claimed they approved that Joseph had been served with the order, the ex parte TPO order. And, in fact, they had not. You know, and that goes to our sufficiency of the evidence claim also, because the corrections officer did not identify Joseph in court, could not identify him, said, yes, I have a signature here, and he had a thumbprint. But the prosecutor told the jury that, you know, the thumbprint and the signature proved it. To prove that, they needed to have a fingerprint analysis. Somebody would think
so. Was that challenged in court? And if I remember correctly, didn't he indicate the process or how he normally handle that in providing service on someone incarcerated in the detention facility?
Yes, he did. The challenge in court, I think, was lack of foundation. I think that was the challenge. I'll have to double check. I think that was the argument, closing argument, that they didn't prove he was ever served with them. And the detective who interviewed him when he was arrested didn't say that Joseph remember being served with exploited TPO. So clearly there was a reason why the prosecutor was making this big statement, because he wasn't able to prove it. And then there was one other statement on the law that he had misspoke about. If I could talk about that in rebuttal, I only have 3 minutes left.
That's fine.
Okay. Thanks.
Thank you. Mr. Logan, on behalf of the state.
Thank you. My name is Jeff Logan, representing the state, as you indicated. May it please the court, I can understand from the questions that have been asked that the concern of the court is with regard to the TPO challenge as well as to issues of prosecutorial misconduct. I can certainly start with the prosecutorial misconduct issue since it was the last one raised. The three issues that were raised by the appellant, two of them I think we can clearly be disposed of as not prosecutorial misconduct. First, arguing facts not in evidence. The appellant alleges that the state can't go and say that the appellant was served with the TPO, because we didn't have a handwriting analysis done, we didn't have a fingerprint analysis done. And that's simply not true. There were facts testified to by a corrections officer that what his habit and routine is in serving a temporary protective order on someone who's in custody. And he testified that he pulls the card, he takes the TPO, he goes to the individual in custody, sits down with them, asks them to identify themselves, goes through a procedure in that regard to make sure that he's talking to the right person. After he finishes going over the TPO, that individual makes them sign it and put his fingerprint next to it.
And was that signature card with the fingerprint admitted into evidence?
The TPO itself was admitted into evidence. I'm not saying that the corrections officer compares a signature card, an independent signature card.
So the card is not in evidence?
I don't even know if there is a card. All I was saying was that he goes through a procedure to make sure he's talking to the right person. If you look at the exhibit that was actually admitted, I believe it's Exhibit 12, and you look at the signature, it is a clear signature that says Joe Truesdale. And there's a fingerprint next to it. Yes, we did not have anyone say that to examine a fingerprint comparing the defendant to that fingerprint that's on that exhibit. However, the weight of the evidence is that it is his fingerprint. So I think that if we look at the totality of the circumstances, what the officer testified to, and actually compare that to the exhibit, that an argument can be made that the signature is of the appellant, and presumably the fingerprint next to it, if we believe what the officer testified as to his habit and routine is, then certainly that is his fingerprint. This is a weight argument. We were simply arguing, based upon the evidence admitted, we've shown that he was served with it. We don't have to show that, we don't have to prove through testimony that the officer remembers or recalls specifically that he served the appellant and identified the appellant in court. There are other ways to do that. And simply saying that our evidence wasn't sufficient is not good enough on appeal to reverse this conviction. The second issue that I think can easily be disposed of is misstating the law. Appellant raises the issue saying that willfulness in terms of violating a TPO includes some sort of requirement that the state prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant subjectively understood the contents of a temporary protective order. It's interesting because previously, in another section of the argument presented, of the brief presented by the appellant, they go into what willful means. And as you, I'm sure, are aware, willful under criminal law simply means that conduct is not accidental, that it is purposeful. It doesn't require that an individual who commits a crime have subjective understanding that his conduct is criminal. And there, the appellant's accusation that willfulness involves some kind of subjective knowledge is simply not true and not required. In this particular case, all we had to prove to enhance the defendant's conviction for violation of a TPO was that a TPO was issued, he was served with it, and he willfully violated, meaning on purpose, during the term of the TPO. And that was met. And when I argued that we don't have to prove understanding, meaning a subjective understanding, that is a correct statement of the law. Now, the meat of the matter, the third argument they make on prosecutorial misconduct is certainly my argument when I said that appellant's trial counsel is trying to confuse you and that he's invoking sympathy. Now, under the law that this court has established, the state cannot disparage legitimate defense tactics. And certainly an appeal to sympathy cannot be characterized as a legitimate defense tactic. In fact, it's prohibited, and there's instructions specifically on it instructing a jury that they have to disregard emotion and look at the facts and not be persuaded by an appeal to sympathy. So I believe that the state is entitled then to call a spade and say, this argument is trying to invoke your sympathy. This argument is improper. Look at the facts. Don't go with emotion. So in that regard, I don't think that saying that this is that the appellant's counsel is trying to invoke your sympathy is prosecutorial misconduct at all. With regard to my statement that they are trying to confuse you, I think that's a closer call. And that was certainly an unintentional statement that I made. And if you look at the entire argument that I was making at the time, I was imploring the jury not to be confused by the facts that were presented.
Did the defense object to your statements?
Yes, at that point.
And did the judge sustain the objection?
He did.
And did he instruct the jury to disregard that?
He did not. Counsel did not ask the judge to issue such an order, but the objection was sustained. And it was immediately corrected. And if you look at the preceding sentences and the sentences afterwards, the point was, and I was trying to make at the time, was you can't be confused with all these facts that are raised about whether Mika, the victim in the case, was still in a relationship with the defendant, when and how they broke up, whether they were still communicating after the fact. All of those were immaterial to the question of whether the appellant committed the offense. And certainly I think that if you do find that it was improper for me to say the appellant's counsel is, and that's not exactly what I said, that they are trying to confuse you, is prosecutorial misconduct. It's it's certainly something that is that did not affect the juror's decision in totality in looking at the entire argument.
Counselor, as you turn to the primary argument that was presented, the other argument as to this TPO.
Yes.
If I understand it right, and you can walk us through, wasn't there information as to how the TPO was obtained presented in the preliminary hearing prior to the trial?
Yes, I believe it was. And I haven't read the preliminary hearing prior to this proceeding. I focused solely on the trial transcript. And I was not the attorney that handled the preliminary hearing, so my knowledge of it is vague at this point. But it was, and I believe it was admitted actually as the TPO was actually admitted as an exhibit at the preliminary hearing, and there were some questions or some testimony regarding how it was obtained.
I asked that question because defense had asserted that they became aware of it at the time of trial, not based upon the preliminary hearing. So I was just trying to correct my understanding of that issue.
And that brings up an interesting issue, too, because appellant's counsel told you that this is like Brady material. The state has a duty to turn over that statement. In the appellant's brief, however, they said that this was required under the Discovery Statute 174.235, and now they're asserting that it's also Brady material. But if you look at the statute, NRS 174.235, the state only has a duty to allow defense counsel to come over and inspect and copy these statements. So it's not incumbent upon the state to seek out defense counsel, call them up, email them, fax them these statements if you're to consider this a statement of a witness that we call. But it's incumbent upon the defendant's counsel to come forward and say, let me see these. And that wasn't done until Sunday night before trial.
Is the application for the temporary protective order and the order public record?
I don't know if it's public record. You asked the appellant's counsel whether it's available through case management system.
I think Odyssey, is that the name, I think, of the court case management system?
I don't know what it is. I that computer system, I think we can refer to it as. I know that I can, I could obtain it through district attorneys who are working down at family court, because it is available to them. I certainly don't have access to those records. It's not something that I would normally request, because I don't think it's proper to go through those types of channels. I don't think that it's something that's sealed. Obviously, it's something that needs to be communicated to certain authorities to ensure that the order for protection is enforced. But it's something that defense counsel could have sought out on his own, and it's something that was not in our sole care and custody, unavailable to him, and only available through myself and my co-counsel.
Right. And I think the appellant, too, is arguing, among other points, that under NRS 33.020 subsection 5, that it's necessary to have a telephonic conference between the applicant for the TPO and the court official. And in this case, the evidence showed that the communication was with Safeness, so it was not, the applicant didn't make the phone call to the court, the representative, Safeness, a place where apparently Ms. Bennett went, made the request on her behalf. What's your knowledge of the record on that?
Yeah, but the record actually is very light on this issue, primarily because even though counsel was invited to address this issue by the trial court post-verdict, it wasn't done. So the record is entirely devoid of any kind of factual scenario, I believe, for this court to make a determination as to whether and how Clark County is enforcing 33.020 or making that 24-hour hotline available, and whether, in fact, the way that they do it violates any provision of 33.020.
As an issue, though, for this, the reviewing court, one of the things that caught our attention was whether or not the defense should be able to collaterally attack the validity of the TPO in this proceeding.
Yes.
And whether or not you have issues of due process involved.
Certainly a collateral attack, as we point out in our answering brief, is not supported. An attack on this type of court order needs to be made in the place, in the court, where it was issued. And as we cite in our brief, there's lots of case authority under other circumstances where this court has said, If you have an issue, if you have a problem with an order issued by a court, return to that court. You can't go to another district court and void that the issuing court's order.
Aren't those mostly civil issues, civil cases?
The principle here is still the same. And I can certainly liken it to also the Supreme Court's decision regarding convictions for an ex-felon in possession of a firearm. It used to be that people who were charged with that in federal court would come and say, my state conviction, my felony conviction is void. And the Supreme Court said, doesn't matter. Until you attack the validity, the enforceability of that felony conviction in the venue where you obtained it, for our purposes, it's valid. And the same principle applies here. We can't make each individual person that will law onto themselves able to willy-nilly avoid an order of the court. And if that's the case, then the defendant, the appellant, has to, it can't attack it now subsequent to its issuance. He had to have gone and attacked it at that point. And certainly with regard to domestic violence circumstances, it's very important that the proper procedure be applied. We don't want abusers going back to their victim saying, and violating an order for protection, saying, I'm going to defeat this order for protection subsequently if you try to enforce it.
Can I ask about one other issue? I know Ms. Dickinson didn't get a chance to get to, but I think she might address the jury instruction that they proposed, but the lesser included to have home invasion, a separate home invasion offense as a lesser included to the conviction, in this case of home invasion violation of a temporary protective order. Why wouldn't that be a lesser included, especially if there's an issue on the validity of a temporary protective order?
Home invasion would be a lesser included of home invasion in violation of a temporary protective order, and that was allowed. It was on the verdict form. The issue that was raised by appellant in this case is whether misdemeanor convictions of malicious destruction of private property or trespass are lesser included. And under this case level, this
was... Sorry, I misread that. I misunderstood that.
That's fine.
Okay.
With my remaining 50 seconds, I do want to raise the final point that this TPO, there really is not enough of a record for this court to make a decision. We didn't have an evidentiary hearing. We didn't have any facts presented that the district court could make a determination. And certainly the record is absent any knowledge that this court could also make a decision. Appellant's counsel is relying on fax numbers and presumptions and speculation. If appellant still wants to attack the TPO, he can do it through a post-conviction writ of habeas corpus saying that his counsel was deficient in failing to raise the issue post-verdict, and then there can be a hearing. But it's not right now. There's no facts that would allow this court to determine the merit of that argument. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Dickinson, your rebuttal.
If I could just start off with the TPO, I looked at the preliminary hearing transcript quickly, and when I did not see any information that suggested that she did a telephonic affidavit. The defense attorney asked, you never filled out any type of paperwork prior to that. And she said no. So the questions are a little confusing, but it does not, to me, quickly looking at it, indicate that we were told she did a telephonic affidavit, but we were told she called SafeNest. I did confer with the trial attorney, and it's his understanding these documents were not available online. I don't know if they are now, but I don't believe he had the ability to obtain them. With regard to the challenge down in Family Court versus Criminal Court, I did mention the search warrant, and the court correctly said, well, that's the same case. I want to point out also in DUIs and in third offense battery DVs, we challenge the conviction regularly, and those are from different cases. We challenge them in front of the judge and say, you know, it wasn't valid, you didn't have an attorney or whatever, so we should be allowed to challenge a TPO in this case. Also, I understand the court doesn't want people running around breaking orders. but I think we should be able to challenge a procedure that does that violates due process, and that's what our contention is the procedure the family court is currently using violates due process, because the telephonic ex parte TPOs are supposed to be very limited. And if you look at any of the other states, they only allow them in very limited circumstances, really like an emergency. If you look at NRS 33.02 of subsection 5, it's almost limitless. But there are some restrictions on the court. The court has to ask the victim or the alleged victim a few questions. The court also has to confer with law enforcement. Well, we don't know if the law enforcement situation even occurred.
In Nevada, this emergency TPO, isn't it based upon a situation where the defendant has been lawfully arrested?
Well, that's
as a precursor, I'm not getting into the other issues you're raising, but just the underpinnings of this type of TPO.
That's correct, but so does subsection 1, the verified, asked if there's been an incident prior. So both of them do ask for that information, though the telephonic one is limited to that situation. But I would suggest we need more than that. Otherwise, we can just have a rubber stamp down at the jail. And just every time they're arrested, go ahead and do 5-7 days or whatever automatically. That's why this needs to be narrowly construed.
We are concerned with that, and we are concerned with the safety of alleged victims in this. And as you have indicated, I'm going to give you a little more time, but in this situation, we did have someone who was also lawfully arrested based upon domestic violence, but that doesn't in any way deter from the argument you're making as to the validity of this TPO and following the other requirements. You have 2 seconds, but I'll give you about 2 minutes to just respond to any issue you feel you need to respond to that was raised by the state.
I just want to add one more thing about the TPO. NRS 33.019, the legislature gave the magistrates the ability to review these and submit them then to a judge. They did not give SafeNest any authority to do anything. With regard to the other issues, the jury instructions, I'm not sure if this is a question the court was asking. We submitted trespass and malicious destruction of private property, which I think clearly are lesser included of home invasion. In fact, the Knight case suggests that trespass is a lesser included of home invasion. The malicious destruction here, for home invasion, we have to show force, and they have to show some damage. So malicious destruction would also be a lesser included, and the court refused both of those. With regard to the closing argument, the misstatement of law had to do with this. They did not have to prove the defendant understood the order, and we objected. They did need to prove that he received it and understood it. I mean, if somebody just handed it to him, threw it to him, they needed to prove something more. Yet, in closing argument, they argued they did not have to do that. I wanted to point out that, getting back to the TPO, in other jurisdictions, things are very limited. The judges have to strictly follow the statute, and they require verified sworn petitions, which is what is not required under subsection 5. I don't know if you have any more questions or if I...
Any additional questions?
Nope.
With that, thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel for the audience. This day, this matter will stand submitted. Please stand in recess to the next call of the court.